Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. May God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Be seated. This morning, the court has three causes on its oral submission docket. In the order in which they will be heard, they are as follows. The City of Tyler versus Adeline White from Smith County. Hyundai Motor Company and others versus Mario Alvarado from and others from Webb County. And Leftmark Management Company versus Winona Old from Harris County. In each of these causes, the court has allotted 20 minutes for oral argument. The petitioner may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by so advising the marshal of the court. We will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each argument and will complete the arguments before then. These arguments are being recorded for the convenience of the court by the clerk. You may purchase a tape of the arguments by May inquiry with our clerk's office. The court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in Tyler versus White.
May it please the court, Mr. Graycheck will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 7 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, my name is Greg Graycheck and I'm here today representing the City of Tyler in an action that arises out of a flood that occurred more than 10 years ago in April of 1986. This flood involved water entering the house of the respondent, which was built in 1950. And the original complaint concerned an insufficiency of the drainage culverts that were installed in 1925 and 1938. Interestingly as well, the 1986 flood that allegedly was a result of insufficient drainage was the first time that water had entered this house from this particular drainage ditch. There are two primary issues before the court today. The first being, what effect does Section 101.061 of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code, part of the Texas Tort Claims Act, have on this case due to the fact that these structures were built nearly 60 to 70 years prior to the incident in question? And secondly, can a property damage claim in general give rise to compensable mental anguish damages? And specifically, if so, can those damages arise under the Texas Tort Claims Act in light of the dichotomy provided by the legislature? It is important at the outset to remember that when this case was originally filed by respondents, they sought only property damage, claiming that due to the negligent and insufficient drainage provided in this particular area, that the city had unconstitutionally taken either temporarily or permanently their property. It was only after the city filed its summary judgment action showing that the original claim was in fact baseless that respondents added a claim of unspecified mental anguish damage.
Shouldn't we always disregard amended petitions?
I think it's important in this case, Your Honor, to look at the fact of what they originally thought they were trying to claim.
Should we disregard an amended petition? Yes or no?
No.
All right. Thank you. Go ahead.
No. Although the petition, the original petition, I think, has an impact other than the effect of what the amended petition brought forward. This case, I believe, provides substance to this court's concern expressed in the past that mental anguish damages would become the refuge repository for every type of damage, whether it's substantiated or not, or at least the repository for unchecked damage awards by the juries.
You didn't move for summary judgment on the basis that she suffered no compensable mental anguish damages, did you?
It's our position that we did move for summary judgment on their issue by claiming that there was no damages available in this case that they pled for that they were entitled to.
Under the Tort Claims Act?
Under the Tort Claims Act. Specifically, we alleged in our summary judgment evidence, and I believe the proof showed, that only property damage would be sought.
So that's a no evidence point on the damages.
Well, it's a summary judgment case. It would have to be a no evidence point at least on the damage question. If we've established that there was no such damage and they have not brought forward that proof, the summary judgment should be sustained.
So the Court of Appeals was in error on page 4 when it said that you didn't move for summary judgment on the basis that Light suffered no mental anguish damages?
I believe that's correct, Your Honor. I know respondent hits hard on that we didn't specifically say you did not suffer mental anguish damages. What we did say was that the damages you're seeking to recover, the damages that you brought forward, are not mental anguish damages. They're property damage. That's all they've ever been. You're simply trying to call them something different to recover or get past the bar provided by the Tort Claims Act. The Tyler Court of Appeals, despite this court's repeated rulings on mental anguish damage awards, ignored those rulings and instead, relying on 3 no-writ cases, found that damage due to flooding is the type of damage that makes it self-evident that mental anguish damage would occur. The flooding damage that the Tyler Court of Appeals found created a self-evident mental anguish situation is in fact directly contrary to this court's holding in Parkway versus Woodruff, where this court in fact found that a jury which apparently concluded that flooding was an event from which mental anguish may be inferred was in fact a conclusion that was at odds with the very definition of mental anguish damage. The court there going on to explain that flooding is one of those events that happens regularly in our society, especially if you live in East Texas. The court found there that because there was nothing other than the flood to point to give rise to mental anguish damages, that the jury's award necessarily had to be based on sympathy or other jury personal experience, which is not a proper basis for an award.
Why doesn't the affidavit of Ms. Likes, where she said she suffered many sleepless nights and lost sleep because of the flooding, and then she, when she heard thunder and rain, she'd get up at night and have to move her, feel like she had to move her car up the hill, why isn't that the sort of disruption in one's daily routine that would satisfy the Parkway test?
That is, in fact, what respondent is contending, is that her suffering is better than the Woodruff suffering was. And then she goes on to claim basically these nebulous claims that, well, I suffered sleepless night, I suffered mental anguish. She makes some conclusory statements. But if you look at what she's actually claiming, both in her petition and in her affidavit, she always ties what she's claiming to the property damage she suffered. In her petition, she states that she suffered mental anguish, emotional pain, torment, suffering from the loss of many personal and irreplaceable items.
Why isn't that good enough, the part I just read or referred to, why isn't that good enough to satisfy the disruption of one's daily routine aspect of the Parkway test?
Again, that comes from her affidavit, the part that she read, and I believe if you read that entire provision, it starts out, this flooding caused me to suffer mental anguish, torment, emotional suffering, as many irreplaceable items were irreparably damaged, and I suffered a tremendous loss of money and property. Further, this mental anguish, the mental anguish caused by the loss of her property, was aggravated by the invasive nature of the flood. I felt violated, and et cetera, et cetera. She's continuously and constantly tying her feelings, her emotions, to the suffering that she's lost in property, in money, in pictures, in keepsakes, in having to repair the damage afterwards. In for a long period, I would hear thunder at night, and I would feel compelled to move my car up to the top of the hill. Again, it's her car she's concerned about, not her personal safety, not her person, it's her property she's concerned with. And that's what she's moving up to the top of the hill. If as respondent alleges that she's so deeply affected by this event that she just can't get on with her life because of it, we would ask, why is she still living in that house some 10 years later? Why is she still residing there without any concern about moving, building up a wall around the property or something to keep the water out? She lives there day to day to day, and the only time that it affects her so traumatically where she's got to just ruin her life is when it comes to the court of law asking this court to award her money damages.
Let's suppose it is ruined, and the evidence of that was uncontroverted.
I'm sorry?
Let's suppose that the evidence was uncontroverted that her life had been ruined. Take another case, if you will. Is she entitled to recover then under the state of the law? If she can show that she did have to move, it ruined her marriage, she couldn't sleep anymore, etc.
It's our position, Your Honor, that no, she still would not be entitled to recover. Mental anguish damage And again, we get back into the entire evolution of this damage, beginning with the requirement that you have to have a physical impact, some type of physical injury in order to give rise to the damage. The courts have found that that was required to show that the damage was genuine.
Well, that's not the law anymore.
No, it's not the law anymore.
Isn't mental anguish a physical injury under our law?
Mental anguish, well, and then we get into, you know, which comes first, the chicken or the egg.
Answer my question, please. Is mental anguish a physical injury?
It is considered a physical injury. That's correct. But again, when we start analyzing, especially when you limit personal injury, like in the Tort Claims Act case, you start analyzing which comes first, the chicken or the egg. If she doesn't have a physical injury, she can't have property. But if the property gave rise to the mental anguish, is mental anguish a personal injury, even though it's related solely to property? And we would contend that even if mental anguish damages is recoverable because of loss to property, which is really what we're talking about here, if loss to property can arise damage, mental anguish damage, we would contend that the legislature's dichotomy in the Tort Claims Act between property damage and personal injury damage would prevent mental anguish damage arising from property damage under the Tort Claims Act situation.
You seem to be arguing, and let me be sure I understand, that if the mental anguish is over a property loss, then it's not recovered.
That's in essence what we are arguing, Your Honor, that property damage alone should not give rise to personal injury damage, because then we start getting into an analysis of what's enough property damage. Is one timber enough, a landscape timber floats away in a flood, is that enough to give rise to a mental anguish?
How do you square this argument with DTPA cases, which recognize mental anguish?
The DTPA cases, and most of the cases that this court has found gives rise to mental anguish damage, all involve some type of culpable mental conduct or culpable conduct on the part of the defendant. The DTPA case requires a knowing violation by the defendant, just like this court's recent announcement under 2121. A knowing state of mind is required in order to give rise to those damages.
If this had been reckless conduct on the part of the city, they've been told over and over again, you've got to fix this, you've got to fix this. They said, we don't have to and we don't care.
I would contend reckless conduct would probably be sufficient if you have evidence of something other than just the violation or the damage itself. If you can show a willful conduct, reckless, conscious disregard, those that give rise to a heightened standard of damage under our law would probably be sufficient to make the damage cognizable, because then it is likely such damage would occur.
Well, wait a second. Conduct, there are many occasions when someone may engage in intentional conduct and the person who suffers the injury truly really isn't all that injured. But there may be other occasions where someone doesn't engage in intentional conduct. It may be just the most vaguest of negligent conduct, but someone could suffer immeasurably. It seems, doesn't it, that we should be focusing on the extent to which the person who is injured has suffered, as opposed to the extent to which the person causing the injury may be culpable.
I don't believe so, at least not at a threshold level.
So it doesn't matter the extent to which Ms. Likes may have suffered. All that matters is whether or not the government, the city of Tyler, intentionally caused her to be suffering.
No, if you get past the threshold where you're entitled to recover mental anguish damages, then the degree of anguish would be necessary to be proved in order for a jury to award those damages. But there must be, I believe, and I would contend in this day and age especially, there must be some threshold that mental anguish damage is not available until you pass that threshold, whether it be a culpable mental state, certain relationships like a doctor-patient some relationship that gives rise to a heightened duty. Absent those types of things, mental anguish simply becomes this blank check that the jury is given to fill in when they decide a case. That's the danger there. Culpable mental anguish, there has to be some threshold to get to it.
Let me ask you a question, a personal question. Let's say when you got back, I don't know if you're from Tyler or Longview or where you're from, let's say you got back to your house after this oral argument and your house was wiped out with the flood. Would you just be carefree and fancy and happy?
No, I can actually speak from personal experience, and I tell you that I wouldn't be carefree and happy.
You would be upset and frustrated.
That's correct, Your Honor.
You would suffer mental anguish, wouldn't you? You would feel anguish about the loss of your house and that property and what you have to go through to repair your house.
There are those that would contend stepping up to this podium causes a degree of anguish or mental anguish.
Especially this morning.
Especially this morning. That's exactly my point. When do we reach a level where that anguish becomes compensable? The fact that my house floods, if it's not from something that was done intentionally or maliciously or recklessly, at least by a governmental entity, it's not something that I should be able to be recovered for. Although the property damage, if it was caused by somebody's negligence, I could recover for. But the legislature has said, at least as far as a governmental entity is concerned, you may not recover for that.
Mr. Graycheck, if the court concludes that mental anguish can arise from property damage, is the affidavit by Ms. Light sufficient to get past a summary judgment in this case? Do you understand my question?
I understand your question. I just find it difficult to provide a direct answer in light of the previous authorities that this court has handed down, especially the Parkway versus Woodruff case, where the court outlined the testimony in that case. And that testimony was as intense or more intense than provided by Mrs. Light. And this court found without any problem that simply is not sufficient to give rise to the damage. So I would have to contend, based on the authorities from this court, no, her affidavit should not be considered sufficient, even if property damage can give rise to mental anguish claim.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from the sponsor.
May it please the court, Mr. Jarrell will present argument to the respondent.
May it please the court. Your Honor, I would like to take some exception to a few comments that have been made concerning Mrs. Light's affidavit. And I apologize that in my brief to the court, there were a few typographical mistakes. That first sentence that Mr. Graycheck quoted actually reads, "This flooding caused me to suffer mental anguish, torment, and emotional suffering, period. Many irreplaceable items were irreparably damaged, and I suffered a tremendous loss of money and property." Agreed. That did occur. Further, mental anguish was aggravated by the invasive nature of the flood breaking into my home. I felt violated by the intrusion of the flood water into my house and have not since felt truly safe in my home, both for my personal safety and the safety of my property.
Let me ask you, if the same showing had been made in Boyle v. Kerr, if the plaintiff there had said, I'm sick to my stomach, I can't sleep, I don't feel safe in my home any longer, if she had made those allegations, are you saying that the outcome should have been or would have been different in Boyle v. Kerr?
In Boyle v. Kerr, Your Honor, I apologize, but I'm not familiar with the holding of the court in that case. But I would say that in this instance, that the violation would rise to a level of a compensable injury. Yes, Your Honor, this is true mental anguish. This is not a mere disguised property claim.
Well, that's what I'm trying to slice here. Are you saying that, is it mental anguish, or are you saying it's personal injury, or precisely what are you saying about
it?
Are you saying that in cases where you can only recover for personal injuries, if you show that the mental anguish was such that it rises to personal injury, then you're able to recover? I'm not clear on exactly what your argument is.
Our argument is that this is mental anguish and that it does have a physical manifestation. Perhaps that's the clearer way to say it. The mental anguish that she suffered did have a physical manifestation, and this court has consistently upheld the award of mental anguish damages where there is a physical manifestation of that mental anguish.
But have we ever done so in a case that involved only injury to property?
Your Honor, I would argue that there was more than just an injury to a property. The injury here was similar to it's been similar, Your Honor, to an invasion of privacy rights cases that this court has upheld mental anguish damages. In this case, a person has a zone of privacy, an expectation of privacy in their home. And when that is violated by an event such as the flooding of this magnitude, I would argue that there has been an invasion of a person's expectation of privacy in their home, an invasion
of their privacy. Did you raise that in the trial court?
I did not argue that specifically, but we did in the trial court. The affidavit was before the court concerning the invasive nature
of the water.
Of the water, yes, Your Honor. There was some 3.5 feet of water in this lady's house.
Do you have any authority that says that that type of an event is a constitutional invasion of the right to privacy? That's what you're arguing now, isn't it?
It's similar. I'm making
and what other source is there for, quote, an invasion of a right to privacy?
Your Honor, this court has, Your Honor, I was tying that into the recent opinion of this court in Motor Express versus Jerry and Irma Rodriguez, where it recognized that there are a few situations where a claimant who is not physically injured by the breach of duty may recover mental anguish. And it did quote the Billings v. Atkinson case, which was an invasion of privacy, an invasion of privacy case.
So if your claim was that your neighbor moved the boundary too far over on your side, that's an invasion, isn't it?
And if
that made you suffer considerable mental anguish damages, would they be recoverable?
In a Boundary Act dispute, Your Honor, I don't think that unless the neighbor routed the fence through your front lawn, through your living room, and said that's where it's going to be, that might give rise to mental anguish because you're invading the privacy of a person's home and their expectation for privacy. I'm saying that's an analogous situation.
But you would not recognize recovery in a boundary dispute. If you really suffered, there's no question that the plaintiff really did suffer, had to go get psychiatric treatment because it was very disturbing.
Your Honor, I would say that a boundary dispute, in other words, they fenced off the property and denied you access to it. Well, Your Honor, I'm going to say that yes, I would say that there would be a possibility of mental anguish under those fact circumstances.
It would be pretty close to allowing it in virtually every action where it was really suffered, wouldn't it? Well, what's the difference in that case and just a simple breach of contract where you just really feel like you've been rooked by this thing and you're really upset about it?
Your Honor, in this case, what we have, though, is a city that was maintaining a culvert. And the city had control of the culvert. They were apprised that there was problems with their maintenance of the culvert itself, and that water was backing up in this area. And they did nothing. We have testimony in here that nothing was done in order to take care of that. And that approaches the reckless conduct that was mentioned earlier by the court.
If the city were more innocent, then you should not get mental anguish damages against them in this case.
Well, sir, I think that the court's earlier trouble with placing a person's with trying a person's issue on mental anguish with the degree of culpability of the actor is well placed, because I think you have to look at the mental anguish damages from the person who suffered them rather than viewing the mental anguish through the culpability or lack of culpability of the actor that may have caused them.
What about their argument under Section 101061?
Concerning discretionary action?
Well, they got immunity because they built it in 1925 and improved it in 1938.
Well, there's a little bit of conflict about when it was actually improved. There were two culverts running underneath the Broadway and Dodge intersection. One was probably built by the railroad in the state of Texas earlier on in the century, but there was no records. And then the second one, there's testimony to the effect that the second round culvert was actually jacked through the roadbed sometime in the 50s.
But all of those dates are before 1970, aren't they, which is what 061, that cutoff date?
That's the cutoff date, Your Honor, but there's case authority to the effect that the act simply does not apply.
Which means that they're immune,
well,
except for common law actions for proprietary functions.
Yes.
So what was your allegation that would get around 061?
my allegation was that the if the city was negligent in the construction or maintenance of those culverts, and that those acts of negligence occurred prior to 1970, then it would be governed under common law. And there are several appellate court cases, the Mitchell case that I've cited, and the City of Fort Worth versus Adams, that stand for the proposition that when you would have an act or omission that occurred before 1970, and it would have been a proprietary act of the city at that time, then the city is not immune, and the case should be tried under common law to determine whether or not.
Well, what would be the measure of damages for negligent construction and design?
The measure of damages would be those that were permitted in common law.
Including metal language.
If that's an interesting question, Your Honor. I would say that it would be the state of the common law at the time. I haven't researched this issue because I have not thought of that. I believe it would be the state of the mental anguish, state of the law at the time either the case was filed or the time the commission. Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Your Honor, I would like to point out that there is a point here. There was no allegation by the city in their motion for summary judgment that Mrs. Light suffered no mental anguish damages. Rather, their characterization was simply that Mrs. Light's, that these are merely disguised property claims. And I would refer the court to the transcript at 426 and 427. I believe that what Mrs. Light has alleged in there is not tied to property rights, but is a true statement of the mental anguish she suffered. She suffered many sleepless nights and loss of sleep because of the floodings and the feelings of helplessness and frustration. She further suffered aggravation of arthritis and headaches. And this is not merely the evidence before the court. Was not merely her affidavit, but also the deposition testimony of Mr. Harlan Smith, who was a young gentleman who was a tenant at her house several years after this event occurred. He testified, and I've made references to it in my brief, that she would be up at all hours of night, unable to sleep, and he was kind enough to sit up and talk with her, and that a large amount of what she spoke about concerned the flooding, her anxiety concerning the flooding, and he gives testimony as to headaches, the aggravation, stress, and much that she went through, and I would refer the court to that also. Concerning the negligence issues that were raised by the City of Tyler, I think the testimony of both Ron Fix, that was attached to the summary judgment motion. Mr. Fix is particularly well qualified to give testimony concerning this, as he has several advanced degrees in water management and hydrology, and I believe Mr. Fix is now at the University of London completing his studies in hydrology and water resources. His testimony raised a fact issue in that he said that the channels and the culverts were in an extremely poor state of maintenance, that there were trees growing up, that there was blockage, and he saw the culverts over an extended period of time as the Rotary Club, the downtown Rotary Club, of which he was a member, met in the women's building, and the access to the Rotary meeting had him walk over a bridge where he could observe the culvert, and he observed it all the time. And the testimony to which I referred to in my brief shows that he said that he always saw significant debris blocking the culverts. There were small trees, sand, and debris growing up inside the culverts themselves, and that they were not maintained. And particularly on the other side of the roadbed, that there were large trees and debris, and he stated that it had not been maintained for a large period of time. His testimony further goes on to point out that this blockage impeded the flow of water, and that it quite possibly could have stopped, caused the flooding in Mrs. Light's home. So we believe his testimony does raise a fact issue concerning the negligence of the city itself. Further,
there was a Mrs. Likes reported a statement by Keith Williams, who was an assistant city engineer of the city of Tyler at that time, that he reported that that they were not constructed properly, and that appears in the transcript at 357, 358.
How important to you is it that this flooded in Holland? If it had flooded a carport, would that be the same?
I think it's important that it flooded her home.
If it had been a garden down on the back end of the property, she might not be in time to come. Even if she felt just as strong.
Your Honor, I think it's important that her home, the actual home itself, was flooded. Perhaps a garden flooding, carrying away a prize pumpkin or something for the state fair could give rise for damages. But I think in that case there would have to be more evidence of a much more reckless or intentional conduct. But in this case, there's knowledge that there was a problem with the system and nothing was done to do it. In fact, her testimony, Mrs. Likes' testimony, does go to the effect that she had informed Mr. Williams, and he said the city was not going to do anything about it. In fact, Mr. Williams' testimony is very interesting. In Volume 5 of the transcript, Mr. Williams, first at page 672 of the transcript, he measured 3.5 feet of water in her house. Her home is located at 118 West Dobbs, and he measured some 3.5 feet of water in her house. Secondly, at page 670, and I'm reading a quote. This is concerning the area of Mrs. Light's home. On page 670, he says, the 6 blocks from Chilton Shaw to Dobbs Broadway. He listed, this is in referencing 4 priorities. He did an investigation of the flooding that occurred in the city afterwards, and he set 4 priorities that the city should consider. One, and the second priority was the modification of the 6 blocks from Chilton Shaw to Dobbs Broadway. This is where nearly half the residential flooding happened. In the public's opinion, flooding of one's homestead is a serious invasion of their privacy and can be very traumatic to a family. This is Keith Williams, PhD, assistant city engineer. And he also talks about that there's a quote down there in the third paragraph, the fourth paragraph of that page. He says that the two drainage maintenance crews do the best they can at removing blockage from the open channels, ditches, creeks, and streams, 80 miles of storm sewers, and 3,000 curb inlets, but with so much work, they obviously have set priorities. They do not remove growing vegetation from the creeks on private property. They only remove dead trees blocking the flow of flood water. Drainage maintenance gets an average of only $3 per tile up to support its work. And he further states that on pages 665 and 666 of his reports that he believes that the culvert system at the Broadway and Dobbs intersection where the backup occurred on Mrs. Light's property is inadequate to drain the property. Your Honor, in regards to Parkway v. Woodruff, I believe that, and once again, this is not a no-evidence point, this is a summary judgment case. I believe that Mrs. Light has shown both the nature and the severity.
And she's shown that the flooding, quote, jeopardized her personal safety. That's footnote 10.
Your Honor, I think that can be inferred from having 3.5 feet of water in your house. It'd be one thing if you had a soaked carpet, but 3.5 feet of water could jeopardize anything.
Is it a single-story home?
No, sir. It was a two-story home.
Is there a bedroom upstairs?
I believe it was, Your Honor. But her personal safety, that was an area in the back that was occupied by a tenant, by Mr. Harlan Smith. And
but he's not suing.
That's correct, Your Honor. He was not an occupant of the home at that time that the flooding occurred. but 3.5 feet of water in your home could have jeopardized your personal safety.
Does the record reflect how long she lived in that home?
Your Honor, the record does. She first purchased the home, I believe, from Bernard and Lindsay Wolf in 1954. And she married Colonel David Likes in 1972, and they moved to Memphis for 13 years and returned to Tyler in 1985. And during the time, she had rented the home to a local attorney during that time.
She owned the house, for example.
Yes, that's correct, Your
Honor. Any other questions?
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the Court. The standard must be such that we can be confident it is justice that we are handing out and not a lottery check. When we give the jury that charge, when we give the jury that blank check, we must know that they are properly considering the element of damage of mental anguish. Otherwise, we are no longer meeting out justice, but we are simply distributing wealth. The jury, once back there, as the court has held in Woodruff, can fill in that blank based on a lot of factors that have nothing to do with mental anguish. We ourselves have difficulty determining what is not mental anguish, or at least what is or what is not compensable mental anguish. To allow a jury to consider that in every case would be senseless, as far as I'm concerned, for the justice system.
What do you think is adequate injury in order for someone to be able to recover for mental anguish?
I believe the dichotomy that this court has gone down in its various cases is the proper dichotomy. If there is willful conduct on the part of the defendant, if there is a special relationship between the defendant and the plaintiff that give rise to the cause of action, if there is personal injury, in these situations we can be confident that mental anguish would and should result. In other situations, the fact that mental anguish may in some situations arise or not does not mean that we should provide a remedy for those situations in all situations. I believe, just as Justice Heck pointed out earlier, if we're going to do so in a property damage situation, why not in a contract situation? I've known lots of people involved in contract disputes that get very, very excited, very, very hot, and suffer serious anguish as a result of those disputes. Why not allow them to recover mental anguish as well? I believe the reasoning is clear that those situations should not give rise to a compensable mental anguish claim because those are situations that did not give rise to conduct that should raise that type of damage.
Is this the only? Can you tell me any other types of actual damage which depend not on the plaintiff's injury or state of mind, but depend on the defendant's level of conduct? I mean, we have punitive damages, but what you're articulating here sounds to me like this is junior punitive damages, a way to get around the Supreme Court's, U.S. Supreme Court's increasing restrictions there.
And quite honestly, that's what it's become, at least in the trial courts. If they can't get the punitive, let's try to make the jury mad and put a blank in there, say mental anguish, and let the jury award whatever amount.
But what rationale is there for? And I'm not saying there's not one.
The rationale,
the rationale for saying that it depends on the defendant's conduct
to me,
rather than on what the plaintiff actually suffers.
To me, the rationale is basic, fundamental to our system. What are we supposed to be doing in our justice system? We are supposed to be redressing grievance, providing compensation to make the plaintiff whole. If the system is not doing that, it needs to be adjusted. And in the mental anguish arena, we know the system is not doing that. It's not making the plaintiff whole anymore. It's become a way to hit it big.
So is Parkway wrong?
I think Parkway is correct. Parkway says, no, in all situations you cannot recover mental anguish. There is some language in there, and some people may be reading that to say, well, if I can simply prove enough anguish, I can get there. But I don't think Parkway actually says that yet. I think it's important that we remember here at the end that this is, in fact, a Texas Tort Claims Act case. The legislature, despite the common law requirements, has imposed a specific dichotomy for what may and may not be recovered.
Are you saying that the quantum of evidence to recover mental anguish damages is different in a Tort Claims Act case?
No, I am saying that because the legislature has specifically ruled by its statute that you may not recover property damage, that you should not be allowed to bootstrap on top of that property damage some nebulous mental anguish personal injury claim.
What I can't understand is whether you're making two arguments or one argument. One, you can't recover mental anguish for property damage under the Tort Claims Act, and two, there's not enough evidence to support a recovery for mental anguish damages here. Are you making both those arguments?
Yes, sir.
And you preserve both of those in your motion for summary judgment?
Yes, sir. They're both preserved. In general, mental anguish should not arise from property damage, just like it shouldn't arise from contract. Specifically under the Tort Claims Act.
Under any circumstance.
Well, I think under any circumstance. I've yet to see one that would without something outside. Specifically also under the Tort Claims Act, because the legislature has taken property damage away, you should not be allowed to use that property damage to catapult yourself into a claim. That's the basis of our argument. And I think it's important in a situation with a city such as Tyler, as you heard repeatedly from respondent's attorney, the city didn't do anything. If you read Fiske's affidavit or deposition that they want you to say is some evidence, it's clear what he's saying is, city, you didn't provide enough drainage. We don't care that these culverts were put in 60 years ago. You should have come back in and done a capital improvement project.
What is your response to the argument that when the city did put in the drainage, it was before the existence of the Tort Claims Act, and at that time under common law, what the city was doing was categorized as a proprietary function?
Twofold. First, I think the intent of the legislature in drafting that statute was to put a bar on those types of claims. It was, in essence, a limitations provision under the Tort Claims Act. We're going to let you sue the state or the city or government or forward from 1970. Anything back is out. You can't go back that far. That was the intent of that statute. I think it was intended to prevent them going back and presenting this claim.
Would that not make that an unconstitutional retroactive law?
No, it didn't apply retroactively. It applied prospectively. Prior to that, when the act was passed, you couldn't sue at all. There was
saying opposing counsel is wrong. This was not the type of municipal function for which the city did have liability.
I think definitely opposing counsel was wrong, specifically in his own words. He tells you, we have two culverts side by side. The state put this one in. The city put this one in. If the dichotomy that he proposed is correct, the city is responsible for putting this one in and is negligent and it can be recovered because that's proprietary, but the state cannot be sued because it's governmental. To me, to say you have two culverts side by side, you can sue over one as proprietary, the other one you can't as governmental, is a meaningless distinction. And if that's the law, then the law is wrong. As simple as that. If the same act...
So if there's anything that's a partial cause that is, where the city is prohibited, then it's got to extend. You can't sue over anybody's conduct.
My contention is if the same act is governmental in one situation, that very same act has to be governmental across the board. Otherwise, we're drawing artificial lines or distinctions not to appease legal distinctions, but simply to allow recovery in certain situations.
That concludes the argument on the first call. The court will now take a brief recess.
The audience, please rise.